to silence your cell phones. Thank you very much. And tonight's event is a big start not only to our Distinguished Speaker Series this year, but also to the theme semester in the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts on the universe, Yours to Discover. And that's celebrating the International Year of Astronomy, 2009. It's an opportunity for us to look back 400 years to when Galileo first turned his telescope to the heavens and discovered that there was actually a universe out there to discover. And we can see how far we've come since then. So we have a whole slate of exciting activities in the theme semester in addition to the current series of events. And, for example, next week we're going to be having a talk at the Exhibit Museum by our own Professor Mario Amoteo, who gave a talk in this series last year, as well as two speakers from NASA who will be visiting on Friday evening, and the Ann Arbor Reads Program author, Timothy Ferris, will be here at the Washtenaw Community College. And we just had a big exhibit in the Hatcher Gallery right here on the quad in the central diag of our campus, of fantastic astronomical images, which I hope you won't miss. We just opened that today. So please check out our website. It is www.lsa.umich.edu/universe to see and check out all of the other fabulous events that we have going on. And especially, we're really delighted to open our Distinguished Speaker Series this year, which is bringing some of the very top astronomical leaders in our community to the U of M campus. This series is sponsored by the Department of Astronomy, as well as the Student Astronomical Society, a member of UAC, and Gary Foreman here is the president, as well as the Exhibit Museum of Natural History. Amy Harris is the co-organizer, and the Michigan Center for Theoretical Physics. So we are very excited to start off our speaker series this year with the Moeller Prize, and I would now like to introduce to you Professor Douglas Richstone, who is the Lawrence H. Aller Collegiate Professor and Chair of the Department of Astronomy, to award the Moeller Prize and introduce our speaker.
Thanks very much. I'd like to welcome all of you to this lecture. I did want to say a word or two about the prize. Your flyer has a brief summary of the contributions of Professor Orrin Moeller. He served on the faculty of this institution for two or three decades. And during his time as department chair, he was famous for an aphorism, "Nothing is worth an unpleasant argument." I think he knew that was wrong, but at least he tried to honor the sentiment. The Moeller Prize was established by his family and friends in memory of Orrin Moeller, and it was created to enable the department to bring excellent colleagues to campus for the benefit of the department and the general public, and to recognize outstanding colleagues in the field. We have, since 1987, had roughly 10 Moeller lectures, and somewhat accidentally, the Moeller lectures have come to recognize not only considerable achievement, but to serve as a predictor of even greater achievement. Three of the Nobel Prize winners, Alan Sandage, Ed Solpeter, and Joe Taylor, went on to receive Crawford Prizes or Nobel Prizes. And several others, including Lawrence Aller and Bodon Pachinski, went on to other high honors. So in recognizing tonight's speaker, we are making a prediction that you'll be back in the future and we'll feel even more proud of having you visit. Turning now to our speaker, Professor Chuck Steidel from Caltech, He's someone that we've actually tried to bring to the University of Michigan to be here on a couple of occasions at least, and have never been quite successful in persuading him to do so. He's now the Lee DuBridge Professor of Astronomy at Caltech. He's served as Executive Officer for the Department of Astronomy at Caltech, and he's won numerous prizes already, including the Warner Prize, the Packard Fellowship, a MacArthur Prize, and has given the Lyman Spitzer Lectures at Princeton University. So I'm very pleased to introduce Charles Stidell, who's going to talk about witnessing the formation of galaxies, violence in the young universe. Chuck.
And I almost forgot, there actually is a prize. I have forgotten to hand this to the speaker on other, but there we go.
I'll wait till later to open it.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I'm really looking forward to winning the gold medal in downhill skiing in the next Olympics. No, just a joke. So what I'm going to do is try to explain to you in about 45 or 50 minutes what the last 13 and a half or so billion years of the history of the universe of galaxies has been like, or at least tell you about what we're learning about it now that we that came as a bit of a surprise. And I always like to start any kind of talk by showing, you know, a beautiful picture of the real universe, this one, and a similarly beautiful, but in a different way, picture of a simulation of the real universe. And you know, one of the questions that we, together with theorists, we observers like to try to figure out is whether the two are talking about the same place. And you know, that's how this field moves forward. You know, you look at the real thing, and then you test. You see if you can make something that does that. And sometimes you don't understand how these things got the way they are. And in fact, we still don't understand very well. But it's not for the same reasons that it used to be, as I'll explain. And I was at a recent meeting where people from all different fields gave talks to other people who didn't necessarily know anything about what they were talking about. And I heard a really genuine statement, which I wanted to emphasize. She said, she's a biologist, and she said, you know, the cutting-edge science in throughout the whole world is carried out by children. And that's a really true statement, and I wanted to, most of these people on this picture, these are the people who've done much of the work of all the things I'm going to talk about. The only non-child is Max there, but, you know, he's an honorary child for today. But, you know, these are all youngsters who you know, spend their lives, you know, for 5 or 6 years after they get their undergraduate degree, getting paid $22,000 a year. And going on to a very lucrative academic career. Just kidding. So here's the, here it is, the history of the universe. It's all there. And I really mean that it's almost all there, because this is kind of like doing an archaeological excavation and digging down layer by layer and seeing all the past history, except that it's all superposed on the plane of the sky. And the idea, of course, is that feeding back? It seems a little bit loud. Sorry. So if I told you that little thing right there, that little yellow galaxy there, that thing is seen as you're basically seeing the light that left it about 13 billion years ago. And this one here, probably only 3 or 4 billion years ago. It almost looks like a sort of normal spiral galaxy. The point is that it's all there, and you just have to disentangle it. And the reason that it's all there is that, fortunately, light travels at a finite speed. So effectively, people who study the distant universe are simply historians reporting on what they're able to find. You basically see history happening in real time, is I think the best way to think about it, in the sense that if you observe more distant things, you're looking farther back, and you can move yourself forward in time and get snapshots of what things look like as you go forward simply by using distances that are less extreme. So it's all laid out for us. And this guy, Edwin Hubble, who really went on to fame when he had a telescope named after him, also happened to discover that the universe is expanding. And I'm sure almost everyone's heard about this. And the way to think about it is that everything is rushing away from everything else. And he discovered this on what used to be a lonely mountaintop in the San Gabriel Mountains in Southern California. And this looks like a really pretty picture, but it's purposely pointed away from the Los Angeles Basin, which is why no one uses the Mount Wilson Observatory for anything that requires a dark sky anymore. This is a picture of the Mount Wilson telescope here. And I just wanted to emphasize that what Hubble found is that the farther something away, the farther the galaxy was, the faster it seemed to be rushing away from us. And you can measure that in various ways that I'll talk about right now. So, okay, I'm going to admit it now. I'm going to show a few things that are not pictures, a few spectra. Now, you don't have to know, don't worry, because I'm going to take you through the things that you need to understand about them. And really all I want you to do is recognize that there's a pattern of these little spiky things. And those spiky things are emission lines of various atomic lines. In this case, doubly ionized oxygen atoms. And this is hydrogen alpha here. The point is that it's a pattern that would be fixed. If you were in a laboratory doing an experiment and you could observe those lines, you'd know what wavelength to look for them. But when you observe something that's far away, essentially what happens is all these lines shift out to longer wavelengths. That's called the redshift. You've probably heard that before. And the point is you just use the same pattern, and all you need to do is measure the ratio between the wavelength that you measure and the wavelength that it would have in the lab, and that more or less is how we make maps of past history of the universe. It's very straightforward and simple. And the other thing, the other really nice thing is not only do you get a way to measure how far away things are, you also are learning something about what you're looking at. For example, we know that we're looking at oxygen atoms in this galaxy that happens to be quite far away in this picture down here. And we're learning about the stars that make up the galaxy, and we're learning about how fast things are moving around inside the galaxy, which tells us how much mass it has. So all those things come from the spectrum. Now, very rare, it's kind of too bad, because very rarely will you see a spectrum in anything but, you know, a geek talk. And it's too bad, because that's what actually tells us what things are. And that's really the tool that allows us to really disentangle things. I just wanted to say that essentially you can think of the redshift as being more or less, it's a number that we call Z or Z if you're from Canada or England or someplace like that. So this factor is just it's the factor by which the wavelengths got multiplied. But it also corresponds to the relative size of the universe now compared to the time when the light left the thing that you're measuring. And so you can think of it as if you had a balloon that you're blowing up, and you blow it up a factor of 4 times larger, that would be equivalent to going from a redshift of 3 down to a redshift of 0. And if you look at something that has this kind of a redshift, that was a time when the universe was 4 times smaller. Now, what does that mean exactly? It's not really effective to think of it as really being smaller, but everything was closer together by a factor of 4 on average. So it's just an expansion factor. And 64 times denser. So that means not only were things closer together, but if you had, you know, diffuse gas or something like that in between galaxies, it was denser by that amount. And so the way that things behave is when you have regular materials very different depending on how dense it is. And so the universe's physical conditions are changing all the time on large scales simply because the universe is expanding. It's something we just have to deal with, but it has its conveniences. The reason I wanted to tell you about redshift is both because I knew I was going to not be able to stop myself from saying redshift, and I wanted you to know what I was talking about, but it's also because it's what we actually measure. So when someone says such and such is so many light years away, what they really mean is they measured a redshift and then they measured a redshift and then they looked, let me get a real laser pointer. And then they looked on some, or they did a calculation equivalent to this curve here that told how you map from the redshift that they measured to a look-back time to tell someone how far it was away in light years. This has a significance, though, because this look-back time is, as you might guess, it's how long ago the light left that's arriving for us to observe it. So this is basically the time axis for your history of the universe, and this is the thing that you actually measure. I'm going to be talking about a period in here that looks harmless enough. It's between about these numbers of 1.5 and 3.5, but it happens to be the most exciting time ever to have been alive in the universe. And the reason that it happened to be so exciting is because if you look around the local universe and you look at all the stars and galaxies, about half of them formed in this little, very short 2 billion year interval of time, which is kind of like, you can think of it as the adolescence of the universe. It's not the very beginning. Things had to sort of get their act together for a while, and then all of a sudden, boom, you go from little kid to full-size adult in a very short period of time. And that's what happened during that time that we now know is roughly 9 to 12 billion years ago. And it is a long time ago. And the problem when you have things that are that means it's very distant. You're talking about distant objects. And the problem with distant objects is that they're faint. And that means they're hard to observe. But otherwise, there's nothing stopping us from looking at things that go all the way back till a few hundred thousand years after the very beginning of the universe. The rest of the universe, we can, in principle, see. So this very technical plot shows you what we've been able to learn about how fast stars have been forming. If you added up all the stars forming in all the galaxies per unit volume of the universe, this is what it looked like, and this is what I was talking about, that adolescence, which was right in here. Down here, this was not so exciting because there wasn't anything going on. This is when galaxies were first getting their act together and forming, and I'll talk about how that happens in just a minute. So they do all sorts of crazy things. We'll talk about what that does to the galaxies themselves and everything else around them. And then here we are, sitting down there, just things are really getting dull, and I think Fred Adams is going to take it later on in this talk series to even further to when things get really, really super extended and, dormant. So we're at the, it's the beginning of the end, folks. It's middle age, so I hope that doesn't upset too many people. But there's a lot of things to look back on and enjoy the history of the universe. So here are some coffee table-like pictures of some very beautiful nearby galaxies. Of course, we have a spiral galaxy, an elliptical galaxy, and another spiral. Now, if you ask, well, what do the galaxies look like that were around 10 billion years ago when all these things were going on that I'm going to tell you about? Well, they look kind of like that. The technical word for that is train wreck. I don't know how else to describe the features of these, but I don't think you'd be able to classify most of them as ellipticals or spirals. The Hubble, who was a genius not only at seeing the expanding universe, but at classifying things, came up with the really imaginative title of irregular for things that didn't fit into spirals or ellipticals. So I guess those are irregular galaxies. The only difference is most of the irregular galaxies today are little dirty things that don't amount to much, dwarf galaxies. The ones back here, these were super bright galaxies. They would, by and large, someday when they grow up, to be a really big galaxy, looking something like these here. But back then, they were, you know, they had skin problems and things like that, as one does during adolescence. So let's talk about more of the things that happened. I wanted to show you how things grow in the universe, and the best way to do that is to show you a beautiful simulation that has been done by, well, there are several groups out there that do this kind of thing. There's at least two groups I know of here at the University of Michigan that do this kind of thing. And this is going to take you from a redshift of 28, that is when the universe was 29 times smaller than it is now, to now in like 10 seconds. So, you know, it's not going to be too much waiting around. And so what you're seeing is a box filled with mass. And all that's happening is that you're letting gravity happen. You're just letting little lumps of matter that are a little bit bigger than neighboring lumps are accreting things from their surroundings. And it grows from being that really smooth distribution, which was the way it was near the beginning, to being a very lumpy kind of distribution. And you should imagine that each one of these little bright lumps would also be likely places to find galaxies. So that's how things grow. It's very simple. There's nothing magic. It's very understandable stuff, and just gravity. Another way of looking at it is just sitting in the middle of something and letting the little, it looks kind of like bugs swarming around something sticky that someone's child dropped on the floor. But what it is just the most massive things are accreting. It's having trouble. The universe didn't really work with that herky-jerky nature, but this more or less is just showing you how mass accretes onto bigger, and so you go from small things to big things over time by this so-called gravitational instability process. So how do you make galaxies then? Well, one of the not-so-secrets about astrophysics, which I'm sure you've heard of, is that the embarrassment that almost all that gravity stuff is dominated by something that we haven't identified yet. It's something called dark matter. And you might think that that's really ridiculous to claim that the universe is dominated by something we haven't really identified. We know quite a bit about it. We know how much there is fairly accurately. There are about six times as much of this dark matter as there is normal stuff like atoms, neutrons, and protons by mass. And so it makes the lumps. And then the right way to think of this, I think, is imagine that gas, or you know, the normal stuff, has to more or less go where the lumps tell it to go, because it's subject to gravity too, and the gravity is dominated by that dark matter. And so you can think of it as a little hole that the gravity dug, and you're just then the gas is kind of falling into that. And this gas is then what turns into stars. Now, the really great thing about working on cosmology is all you have to do is say, okay, this gas turns into stars without having to understand how that works, which is really good because it's a hard problem that, you know, some of my colleagues work on and don't understand all that well. But for now, when gas comes in here, it tends to settle toward the middle and cool. And the gas is good at losing energy, and it does that by radiation. It basically, for example, you can form, one example would be to form stars, and then to have something that's luminous radiating energy away. But it also, just regular old gas can lose energy over time, and it tends to sink. And so the normal stuff tends to be more compact than the stuff that's holding it together. So this is a galaxy. Here it is. So you have dark matter, you have normal stuff, and then you have gas cooling. Okay, so what happens then when you turn on those sources of energy where it's putting energy back in? And one example is forming stars, but you've probably also heard of supernova explosions, which are which a single supernova is somewhat disruptive to your life, but having lots of them going off all the time can really mess things up and may partially be responsible for explaining the very disturbed nature of some of those galaxies' pictures that you were looking at. But I just wanted to return to the fact that, you know, we understand more or less how the dark matter should be distributed, and we know how much of everything there is, but we still don't understand how you get all this different-looking stuff and how to explain the history that we now think we have a sort of broad brush picture of. Well, I want to go back to this picture again. So imagine you're a historian and you don't want to spend too long doing your history and you don't want to work too hard because that wouldn't be fun. But you want to understand in detail some particular period in the universe's history. Say 10 to 11 billion years ago, you want to know what that slice in time was like. Well, the most efficient way to do that is to know how to find objects that are at the distances that would make the light travel time to us in that range. So we need some way of selecting galaxies at particular distances, and there are many ways to do this, some more efficient than others. The problem is the way that you find out the distances is by getting those spectra, and that's harder than getting a picture, because a spectrum is basically taking a picture and then spreading it out. And so there's less information in the spread out version. That it's harder to get enough information, I should say. So it's difficult. You would be hard pressed to get spectra of everything. So let's just make it more efficient and only look at the things that are likely to be where we care for them to be. And the way this is done, is not worth going through right now. Suffice it to say that I'm going to show you some pictures that more or less illustrate the idea better, I think. Here's an image of a little piece of the sky. If you imagine the full moon, how big that is on a bright moonlit night, this little piece of sky is about 4 parts in 1,000 of the size of the full moon. So it's a little tiny piece of sky. And this is a picture taken in red light. And it's just, you know, the image from which it came is much bigger, but it's too hard to look at all at the same time. One point is that when you don't have Hubble, most of these things just look like kind of gormless little blobby things. And my wife tells me that they... calls them zits or something like that when she sees these images and wonders how one can spend one's whole life looking at these things. But anyway, each one of these boxes are things that I want you to look at as I just show you pictures that are taken in different filters of the same part of the sky. And this is taken in green light. And it's not really green like that. That is false color. I should have mentioned that bright things are white and the background is dark. So this is green. And then when you go to the ultraviolet, here's the thing that's supposed to be recognizable. You see they how they sort of go away like that? I'll go back and forth a couple more times. Now, what that tells you is that in between the wavelengths of those two filters, something was happening. And the thing that was happening is that the spectrum, the light was going along, going to shorter wavelengths, and then all of a sudden it's like it went off a cliff and there isn't any more light. And the reason for that is that there's a lot of hydrogen gas in any place that's forming stars. Now, the bright stars make the light, especially the young stars, which are really, really good at making light. They're not very long-lived, but they're good at making light, and they're good at turning hydrogen into metals, hydrogen and helium into metals. And I should say that astronomers call everything that isn't hydrogen or helium metals. Silly, right? But anyway, that's what we do. So that's how you find these things. And then you do the spectroscopy, because you probably noticed that it was only a few percent of the images there. And you save yourself a lot of headaches by doing that little sorting thing. But it's hard. You know, this was about staring at the same patch of sky for 150 hours with a space telescope. And so it's not easy. And nevertheless, though, we don't have any dimension in time. And this, the way you get that dimension is with spectroscopy. And all this is counting up the number of objects that have identified redshifts or distances as a function of distance. And so this is the beginning of the time period that we're interested in. And this is the end. And this is what the structure looks like. And I know which one of these falls into which, and that gives you the third dimension. So that's how you make a map of what's going on. You get the two dimensions from what's projected on the sky, and the third dimension from measuring the redshifts. And this is where big telescopes come in, and this is the big telescope in which the University of Michigan is a partner. It's in Chile. And that's a picture. It's two telescopes, actually. Two 6.5-meter diameter mirrors. So that's the thing that collects the light, obviously. And then it sends it to very sophisticated instruments that dissect and then record the light and actually give you digital information that you can then turn into understanding at some point. So these are the people who run that observatory. The one that I actually use is called the Keck, W.M. Keck Observatory, named after an oil magnate who found it in his heart to give us money to build it. And it's on top of Mauna Kea, which is on the big island of Hawaii. And everyone says, well, Hawaii, oh, really tough. You know, you have to go work in Hawaii. I just had this discussion at dinner. And I guess I said I had to go out there soon, but it's not so great. It's a lot of work, actually, but it's spectacular up at this place because here are the two telescopes. They're 10 meters or about 33 feet in diameter, and the surface of these 36 segments, they're controlled to make a single mirror that has accuracy of 20 nanometers or something like that. So it's, if you imagine something 33 feet across, controlled to 20 nanometers, that's an engineering feat. And this telescope or observatory is run by Caltech, the University of California, and NASA. And this is another picture over here. And I love this because that isn't the ground. Of course, that's the cloud layer, which is usually, if it's behaving itself, down about 9,000 feet. So all you see is white, fluffy clouds with the Haleakala volcano on the island of Maui sticking up above because it's about 10,000 feet. So this is going to be a good night on Mauna Kea. And so that's where we do this stuff. So we identify the objects, and then we go. And so then how do we manage our time when we go to the telescope? Well, it's not enough to get one at a time, which is the way this used to be done. Nowadays, what you do, you want to get lots of these things at one time. So you make something that looks like this. And this is basically a piece of aluminum that has little slots milled in it. It's about the size of a sheet of paper, 8.5 by 11 or so. And it has about 40 of these little slits. And these are designed to be precisely on top of some the objects that we want to record. And actually, you see these little squares. Those are where there are stars that help us line everything up perfectly. And then you park the telescope, fix it on that, and you eventually end up with something like that, which, okay, let me tell you what that is. This is a detector. It's sort of like the detector that you have in a digital camera. It's a CCD. Only the ones for astronomy are more expensive. I'm not sure if they're better, but they're definitely more expensive. What you're seeing is essentially the spectrum of the night sky. So you know how it's dark between stars? It really looks like this ugly mess here. And what you're seeing in each case is the image of that little slot, and then the image is spread out by wavelength so that the image of whatever's in the slit at short wavelengths is down here, and the image of whatever's in the slit at long wavelengths is down here, and each one of these rows is a different object. Okay, so that's how it's arranged. So it's not very meaningful, though, because we're not really after the background. But you can see that it's a hard problem. These things are much fainter than the dark sky. So that's why you need huge light buckets to collect all the light. So with some amount of image processing, you can actually see the signal, where each galaxy is spread into what looks like a little snaky thing, worm thing going across after the subtraction of the background. And then you smash that down into one dimension and you plot it, and it looks something like that. Now I'm making you look at another spectrum because it's so beautiful the way you can look at something that's on the other side of the universe, you know, and look at something 10 or 12 billion years ago, and it has the same damn elements that we find here on Earth. And I just find that to be spectacular. And you can identify all these little squiggles. They have real physical meaning, and they're from real things that we understand. The only difference is they're at a completely different wavelength. It's like somebody took this, all the spectrum and threw it over here to long wavelengths, and it allows us to tell all sorts of things about what's going on in the galaxy. So we get that distance, so you get the third dimension. You get the chemistry of the galaxy. You get something about how much gas and how fast it's moving around. You get what kind of stars and how something about how much chemical enrichment has gone on. And you get the mass of the galaxy if you're lucky. Now, one of the things that you can also see in this spectrum, if you know what to look for, is that something very, very nasty is happening in that galaxy, and in every galaxy. And what's happening is stuff is flying out of that galaxy between about 200 or 300 and 1,000 kilometers per second. So that's fast. I don't know what that is in miles per hour. I should have calculated that. Anyway, it's high. It's much faster than your car will go. And this, it's basically what's happening is you're having a huge amount of star formation. It makes it bright enough for us to see it at the other side of the universe. And it's throwing stuff away at the same time. So it's forming lots of stars and getting rid of the gas that's forming the stars all at the same time. And we do find examples of this on a smaller scale in the nearby universe. This is a picture of a nearby galaxy, a fairly famous one. And what you're seeing here is a normal sort of disk of a spiral galaxy. That's something explosive is happening, lots of supernovae actually, in the middle. And what it's doing is blasting stuff out perpendicular to the disk. This red light is basically indicative of gas that's being excited by all those bright stars and supernovae and all that stuff. And it's tracing the gas that's being blown out at high velocity. And what else do supernovae do? Well, they make all the stuff, most of the stuff that's everywhere. And everywhere you look around you and this all came from supernovae. And this type of supernovae that comes from big stars, they're the most efficient. They live a fast life, they die young, and they blow themselves to kingdom come and blast all these great metals that form during that that either during the lifetime of the star or in the actual explosion. So we know about supernova remnants in our own galaxy, and they're fairly pretty things. This one actually was noticed by the famous astronomer Kepler back in the 16th century. There are a few others that are famous. But let me backtrack for a minute and say that at the times that we're looking at, most of the stuff in the universe was outside of galaxies. Remember how things started off smoothly, and then they became more lumpy with time. So as they become more lumpy, what you have is stuff streaming out of places that were formerly low density, from the low density regions into the high density regions, and the place with lots of stuff. And so you have a smooth distribution becomes sort of filamentary as the stuff starts to stream because of gravity into the high density regions. And it looks like kind of a webby sort of structure. But unfortunately, we don't get to see this except in the computers of theorists. All we get to see is the little knots where things are lit up. Now, suppose you want to check whether the theorists are right, or you just want to understand what's going on with all the rest of the matter. You need to see the stuff in between. That means you have to do the scary thing of trying to look between the galaxies, the stuff that's not lit up. And the way you do that is more or less like if you're trying to study climate, the history of the climate, a lot of times they'll drill down and take these core samples so they can see all the ice melt periods as you go back in time. It's sort of similar here, except we're drilling through the universe. And what you do is you find a nice bright thing behind the part of the universe that you want to study. And its light has to go through that stuff. And that what happens is every time it hits a little cloud of hydrogen in the middle of nowhere, it makes a little one of these absorption lines. So each one of these little things is a lump of hydrogen. And it basically, the ones that are farther away from us make the lumps that are toward the high redshift side here, and the ones that are closer to us make lumps here. And so you get this pattern that's totally easy to read. So you learn about how many hydrogen atoms there are in each one of those little lumps. And that gives you the one-dimensional picture of everything that's between the galaxies, whether it's lit up or not, which is kind of fun. And it also, there are other little spiky lines where the wavelengths are sucked up by the atoms at particular frequencies that we know about. And so we can measure the how much carbon there is in each one of those little lumps. So we're measuring how much in the way of products of galaxy formation are sitting out there outside of galaxies. How did they get there? Well, they went blowing, the galaxies went through this explosive adolescence and they blew it out there. And we're trying to figure out how that works. So normally, one has to confess that it really isn't very interesting in the intergalactic medium, because all it is a bunch of hydrogen, for the most part, sitting in these little tiny regions that are not all that dense, not nearly dense enough to form stars, but just to hold a little bit of gas. Now, it turns out that that's interesting because it means they haven't been disturbed by anything, and it means that they're very good at telling us what the little fluctuations of the matter look like. And so you can do all sorts of fancy cosmological things with that information, which I won't talk about, but just to mention that it's useful. And it's really kind of easy to understand how this works, because basically you have a bath of ultraviolet light that's produced by all the galaxies and quasars in the universe that's shining on this stuff. And you don't need any kind of fancy tools to figure out what that's going to do. It's going to ionize the hydrogen, meaning that it'll kick off an electron. And most of that hydrogen is going to be, ionized, which means we can't see it at all. And only this little tiny bit is what we see, the neutral hydrogen. So we can actually measure the matter fluctuations in the universe as long as they're not too big, or as long as this remains boring. So if it doesn't stay boring, then this these little piles of gas are extremely sensitive to being disturbed by something nasty. And so we can sort of use it as a barometer to measure what's going on with the galaxies. And so here, artistic license has been taken by putting in little explosions where galaxies have done things and are blowing metals and everything else out into this otherwise boring place that is suddenly becoming interesting. It's kind of like urban sprawl in a way, where it used to be that people only lived in the city, and now they're sort of moving out into what used to be the middle of nowhere. This is the same thing that happens in the universe we now know. And so we can study this whole picture by doing an experiment that looks exactly like this. We are the eye here. And this is time or distance, same thing, essentially. And, you know, quasars, which I'm going to tell you just a little bit about in a minute, they're really, the thing that you need to know is that they're super bright. They're brighter than any of the galaxies that we can find. And they don't last very long, but they last long enough for us to use as a beacon. And so if you study regions that already have one of these rare things sitting in the middle of them, it means that you can get that core sample with the really high quality information. And then all the galaxies that are either behind or in front of that quasar, here's the span of time you want to look at, all of those can also be used to study the intervening stuff through those same little absorptions. The problem is that these things are, you know, 100 or 1,000 times fainter, and so they're not high quality information, but they have the virtue of being many. they're just way more of these than there are of the quasars. So you combine those two to get a sort of picture of what's going on, and it's not too different from like medical tomography, where you sort of scan slices of things to try to get their three-dimensional structure. This is the same idea. We're doing tomography of the universe, and this is just an illustration about how it works. You choose the quasars to be at this distance, and you study this part of the universe by looking at where the galaxies are and then looking at where the stuff in between the galaxies are and making a maps of all of that. And the ones that are behind the quasar or at larger distances can tell us about all the nasty things that the quasar is doing to the volume of space near it. So this is just, again, it's an efficiency thing. You try to get it all in one place. And so that it turns into an idea that looks something like this. So you map that web, you do that tomography, and you get something that looks like this, where you can identify objects that are in various distances. In this case, the blue things are in front of the quasar, the red things are at the same distance, and the green things are behind. That big bright thing in the middle, it looks bigger than all the other things, but it's actually just a point source, and it looks big just because it's really bright. So this is just a little portion of it. And this is about the distance here. It's about a million light years distance. So we're just going to focus on this area. And when you put all that information together, you get sort of a dartboard kind of map of where you sit on the galaxy, and you can learn about what things were like where there's no light as a function of distance. So you can see how far did those metals that were made by supernovae actually get out there. So you can make that measurement. And this just summarizes the kinds of nasty things that happen during this adolescent phase. So you actually have this huge high-speed outflow. The shock wave produced by that outflow heats the gas up to these incredibly high temperatures, sort of mind-bogglingly high. It gets all those metals, all those things that make all the stuff eventually make planets and all that kind of thing. And how far it gets turns out to be like 100 times bigger than the galaxy. So every galaxy that you see forming stars out there, you should picture it as being sort of the tip of, definitely the tip of the iceberg. And the the far the stuff gets out, you know, close to a million light years away from its source. So if you have a picture like this again, what you should really be picturing is that little thing there is actually affecting that size of the surrounding universe, which is kind of hard to believe, but true. Now, what about quasars? Here's that same quasar looking more unassuming in this picture. You can just see how much brighter it is than any of these little galaxies that happen to be at a similar distance. And so you might ask, well, what does this do to the surrounding area? More energy, shorter period of time. And the answer is, it depends on who you ask. And this is kind of a fun picture. I think I need to click it. So this is a movie that shows two spiral galaxies doing a dance and merging. And we think that this is happening all the time, particularly at early times. And what you'll notice is that what you're seeing is the gas, and the brightness is the gas density. So when things get really bright like that, that's when they are forming huge numbers of stars, because the gas is compressed. Now what you're seeing here is that inside of those bunches of stars, you're also forming a supermassive black hole, which seems to go along with forming huge batches of stars for reasons that are yet to be determined. What happened in this simulation, it's a beautiful simulation, is that the quasar turned on and dumped so much energy into the galaxy that it just went poof, and you saw the gas sort of go floating off into the middle of nowhere. But I told you that it was the supernovae that did that. Which is right? Well, the answer is we're not quite sure yet. They both could be doing it, or it could be one of these all of the above type things. But more than likely, this model just isn't right. just kidding. I think it's a beautiful model, but it's worth saying that just because it works in the computer doesn't mean it's real, which sometimes people forget. So what we really want to look at is, we know that the quasar is producing huge amounts of light. So the interesting thing about this is that you can measure how long the quasar was on. Because when you think about it, the light takes time to get to things that are off to the side. And it turns out, if you look at background things, that you can look and see at what it's doing to the hydrogen that's off to the side in each direction. And where it stops affecting, you stop seeing any difference, that tells you how long that quasar has been on just by dividing the distance by the speed of light. So it's kind of cool because you can measure things just by looking sideways. You can measure how long things have been on for these objects. And this is just the same picture I showed earlier. And this is an illustration of what happens when you blast clouds of hydrogen with really intense ultraviolet radiation. Again, there's the quasar. This circles at about a million light year radius. And the next image, I'm going to have to tell you how to interpret it. So what this image is, ignore the white spots, is just, it's basically what you're seeing is ultraviolet light coming off the quasar and bouncing off little peaks of hydrogen in the intergalactic medium. You'll notice that most of those things are not galaxies. If you blink back and forth and you look at some of these pieces of black emission, they're not galaxies. They're bits of gas that are being lit up. Essentially, the gas is acting like little mirrors directing the light from the quasar at us. And by looking at how far out those things go, you can measure all sorts of interesting things about what the quasar is doing. So just a little food for thought before I show you the last couple of slides just for fun. So everything that you're sitting on and everything inside you was once inside one of these adolescent galaxies and may have moved quite far away before it came back, and was able to be a bit of junk or sitting around a star like the sun that made a solar system. And we can watch all of this happening in real time. The only difficulty is that we can only watch it happening in real time in a distant part of the universe. So again, just to reiterate, essentially a telescope is, it's a big light bucket, but it's essentially a time machine when it comes to studying the distant universe. And we're looking, instead of looking at dinosaur bones, you get to look at the dinosaurs running around, which is kind of an unusual situation for a historian. And we're going to be surprised. The nice thing about astronomy is you don't have to know anything. You just have to go out, and you almost always stumble over things that nobody knows about yet. So, you know, if you're not very comfortable with your own intellect or something like that, and you're sort of not sure you should be a scientist at all, then astronomy is the one for you, because you can design an experiment, but then you're going to end up finding something different, which is really fun. But I want to tell you about what's going to improve the situation in the next few years. So this is Mauna Kea, and you'll notice this kind of Star Wars-looking thing coming out of the dome here. What that is called a laser guide star. And you might ask, well, what does it do? Are you shooting down satellites? Not if we can help it. The Space Command people have to tell us when we have to turn it off, because it's a pretty powerful laser, because what it's actually doing is shining up 80 kilometers into the atmosphere where there's a bunch of sodium atoms sitting around. Now, sodium is the same stuff that's in streetlights, typically, and it's got that kind of orange glow. And that's why it's orange, because it's basically light at one wavelength, only that of sodium, that is tailor-made to go up and tell those atoms up in the atmosphere to get excited and to shine at that wavelength. And what it does is it makes an artificial star. Well, why would you want to do that? Stars get in the way when you're trying to study galaxies. Well, it's because it also tells you about all the turbulence introduced by the atmosphere, which is what makes images taken on the ground lousier than the ones that Hubble takes. And we're trying to get around that problem from the ground. Why would you want to do that? Well, because it's way cheaper to do it on the ground if you can figure out a way to do it than it is to put it in space. Big factors. And I think this is basically the idea. Now, what are you looking at? Ignore this stuff up here. This is what an image looks like if you were taking a picture of a star every few milliseconds. And you see that what happens is it looks like a big bunch, it looks like a swarm of mosquitoes being played at too fast a speed. And each one of those things is a little packet of air in the atmosphere above the telescope that's at a slightly different temperature, moving at different speeds. It's basically looking, it's like the image is being blurred by the turbulence up above the observatory. The one on the right, that's what you really want. It looks like a point, the way a star should. Same star, but it's been processed through a system that takes the information. This is basically can be either a real star or your fake star that you're putting up there. And it takes the information on that turbulence, and it has you can think of it as a rubber mirror that does exactly the opposite of what the atmosphere is doing. And so it takes out all of it rearranges everything, you can think, so that they're all on top of one another. This is called adaptive optics, and it's become a really a big thing in ground-based astronomy. And just to give you an idea about how big it is, here's a Hubble picture. Now, this is the reason it looks so bad, it's a tiny piece of the sky, really, really tiny. But I want to show you what the picture of the same thing taken with adaptive optics on a telescope that's four times bigger looks like. So that is the picture taken with the resolution that you get from the ground if you could get rid of the atmosphere. So just go back again to back and forth, and you can see that it's pretty darn good. And the reason it's good is because the telescope is bigger. And physics tells us that the larger the telescope mirror is, the finer resolution you can get. if nothing else is preventing you from achieving that, if your optics are good enough. So you can even do that with galaxies. Here's some pictures, Hubble pictures, and then pictures taken with this adaptive optics of a few of these blobby little galaxies. This is way too complicated, but the point of this is that sharpening the images improves your sensitivity, not just because you needed a bigger telescope to do it. Obviously, you collect more light, but it also gets you higher spatial resolution at the same time. So whenever you increase the diameter of your telescope, you can increase the sensitivity by about d to the fourth, where d is the diameter to the fourth power. So that means when you go from a 5 meter to a 10 meter, you're increasing the sensitivity by a factor of 2 to the fourth power, which is 16. And when you go from a 10 to a 30 meter, that would be 3 to the fourth power, which is a big number, like, 81, something like that. That's a huge factor in gain in sensitivity, and that's why we're constantly trying to build bigger telescopes. So this is the biggest one right now. This is the Keck mirror, and this is the kind of thing that people are trying to get to nowadays. And just to give you a sense of scale, here's a person, and here is an array of mirrors. This is based on the same technology, more or less, that that went into the Keck telescopes, only it's 10 times bigger collecting area. And these are some pictures of this is the kind of thing that it's going to make the kind of thing I talked about tonight way, way better than it is now, and all sorts of other science at the same time. And there are about 3 of these projects right now going on, all of which are well along in designs, but looking for money. it's where the kind of science that I was talking about is going to happen. Not Hubble. Not things like Hubble. Hubble's great for taking pictures, but it's a small telescope at the end of the day, and it doesn't collect all that many photons. And so it's much harder to get spectra. So just leaving you with this picture of things that don't yet exist, but have pretty pictures anyway, I'm happy to take some questions about what I talked about. Thank you. Okay, yeah, I'm going to repeat your question so that everyone can hear me. So the question was, he understands how you get more light by having a bigger mirror, but couldn't you get the resolution by having basically distributed apertures? The problem with distributed apertures is that the sensitivity is not there at the same time, but it's more that the control that you have, the sort of... depending on the wavelength of light you're trying to look at, it becomes more and more difficult as you go to shorter wavelengths to control things to the level you would have to make use of the distributed aperture. It's with a monolithic thing, for raw sensitivity plus the resolution, it's better. And these telescopes are built to handle all sorts of problems, some of which are limited by sensitivity and others by angular resolution. So the sort of happy medium that does a good job for almost everything is something that looks like that.
Yes.
Okay, so the question is, what is the next Hubble? Well, it's called the James Webb Space Telescope, and what it is it's a larger telescope. It's about a 6 meter telescope. It's being launched, if we believe what we're told, in 2013. Is that still right? 2013 for database team. It's being launched soon, and it's expensive, like Hubble, and is optimized for the near-infrared rather than for the optical and ultraviolet, on the grounds that it's just what I was talking about, really, that drove us there, because to look at more distant things in the universe, you have to sort of move to longer wavelengths. And so it's like a Hubble that's optimized for light that's longer than what we can see with the naked eye. It's infrared light. And it's a big, big project. It's probably the biggest space sciences project at NASA. Is that right? That NASA has in the works now. So that's what's happening next.
Yes. Okay, my understanding is that people spin around the object, but apparently not.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Well, you mentioned using tomography.
Yes. Right, so I guess that's giving you an image from all angles, and this is basically a bit different, where you're trying to put together a three-dimensional distribution of stuff by having lots of one-dimensional samples of it. It's a bit of a different problem, but the same general idea, where you're taking limited information and trying to put together a three-dimensional distribution. In fact, it's a very similar problem to the adaptive optics, where you're trying to put together the turbulence profile of the atmosphere by having little samples through it with laser guide stars.
Isabel.
Yes.
So I'm going to have to get closer so I can make sure. We have a microphone.
Yeah.
Maybe we should give her a microphone. In fact, we should probably use this. Do you mind saying it again into the microphone so everyone can hear your question?
That if at the beginning of the universe there was an explosion, the atoms should be distributed evenly, so then why would they form clumps?
Okay. You're basically right, and they were very even at early times, but even the smallest little lump, if given enough time, grows into a really big one. It's kind of like a snowball rolling down a hill, and so you start off with really small things, and they become big only after a long time.
But where does the first lump come from? Like, why do you get the first lump?
Ah, that's a very good question. That's a job for physicists. just kidding. It's a very good question, and it's not, we don't really understand the details of where we don't know roughly how big the lumps were, but we don't know really what made them. Sorry, that's the best I can do. So the question is, how do you know that since the lines are at other wavelengths, what you're looking at? And it's basically pattern recognition, because it's the same. You have all these, you have many lines, and they're all if they're coming from something at a particular distance, they're all shifted by exactly the same factor. So if you find the whole pattern shifted by the same amount, you can basically identify all those lines. It's not, and then sometimes the lines happen in little pairs that are sort of unique separations that allow you to identify. And then you say, well, where would all the other lines be if I identified these as, carbon, triply ionized carbon, and then you can identify all the rest of the things. So it's kind of fun, actually. It's kind of like putting a puzzle together. And sometimes you're left with things that you're not sure about, the odd line that you can't identify, and that's the most fun, trying to figure out what that kind of thing is.
Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. Yes.
And then you showed another photo of the quasar where it was exciting for the energy is different.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so the short answer to the question, which was, if the gas that's being expelled is sort of going along poles like that nearby galaxy was, you know, how would you necessarily expect it to have any influence on things that were in different directions? The answer to that is that galaxies at early times didn't look like that. They tended not to have disks, and as far as we can tell, they sort of blast away in a relatively isotropic or, you know, uniform way. Obviously, we can't measure. We can only reach that conclusion statistically. We can't see all directions from anything, and the same is true for the quasar. I mean, if it weren't shining in that direction, we would certainly not see any reaction. We would be scratching our heads trying to figure out how it is that this really bright thing doesn't have any influence at all, as far as we can tell. The fact that you do see things tells us that it's shining in that direction, too. It's a good question that I actually don't know the answer. So the question was, how did Hubble make the connection? I mean, he might have just plotted things, and you know, sometimes. Yeah. So how did those measurements? How were the distance measurements made? If things are close enough, you can use other techniques to measure distances. And fortunately for Hubble, he had figured out a way to measure distances fairly far out of galaxies, far enough out so you start to see the expansion of the universe. Turns out he got completely the wrong answer, because he actually got the distances wrong by a fairly large factor at first. But I guess people didn't hold that against him all that much, because the principle turned out to be correct. And, you know, it also... You know, I don't know the details, because it's been a while since I've read all the stories. But, you know, there was quite a bit of theoretical work that was prior to Hubble's time that might have predicted such a thing, had they been paying attention to one another. And you know, Mount Wilson was a pretty famous place, and you know, Einstein was there soon after Hubble made his discovery and all that kind of thing. Maybe someone else knows the full story. I can't remember how it went. It might have been luck, or it might have been, you know, just plotting everything you know on a graph. Sometimes that's what you do when you don't know what else to do and you're trying to figure out what does it mean. I don't know the details, though.
Yeah.
No, okay, so that's a good question. So the question is, if the universe is expanding, then how is it that you're all sitting here and you're not expanding? Well, it's very simple. Any place that's gravitationally bound or being held together by other forces doesn't participate. It's really only on large scales that the space is expanding. And what happens is, if you have too much gravity, that's how things become bigger. The gravity overcomes the tendency for things to get farther apart, and so you have things collapse, and once they collapse, they don't change shape once they get gravitationally bound.
So, if I could interject, actually, we're getting slightly closer to Caltech at the present time.
I'll take his word for it.
Yeah.
I was wondering how gravity affects how the wavelength. Okay, yeah, that's a good question, actually. So the question was, we know about certain atoms or ions have atomic transitions that make spectral features at particular wavelengths, and so we know that that's affected by the expansion of the space, but what about gravity? And the answer is gravity affects it too, but you don't really notice the effect outside of places that have really super strong gravity. There are some places where so-called gravitational redshift is important, but on these large scales, it's not.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So that's not really quite. When people say the edge of the universe, that's not really what they mean. In this case, you know, the light's been traveling from it. So the question was, how do we know if the light left an object 13 billion years ago? How do we know anything about that part of the universe now? You know, what would it look like? Or how do we know that? How do we know that it's near the edge of the universe? So it's not near the edge of the universe, it's just near the edge of the observable universe. So we can only see the part of the universe that light could have traveled in the age of the universe. So there's parts of the universe that we're not going to see until the future because they're too far away. We can say on many other grounds what the age is, and it has to do with knowing something about the history of the expansion. Now, there's a bit of extrapolation or interpolation involved, but it's uncertain by a few hundred thousand years, probably. So it's a rough number, but it's not debated as much as it was 15 years ago or so when people used to have raging debates about how could it be that the oldest stars in the universe are older than the universe itself and all that kind of thing. You don't hear that much anymore. So I think it's not from this observation. And of course, I think that's the best I can do right now.
So what I'd like to do, I'd like to cut the question short, although anyone is invited to come up afterwards. There is going to be either a planetarium show or observing at Angel Hall, and I think people are invited to collect at that door to go over with the Student Astronomical Society students if you want to go to that. And I'd just like to remind you, in this same speaker series, we have Dr. Alan Stern on February 6th. There's Mario Mateo next week in the Eyes on the Universe lecture series, and then there's the Exhibit Museum opening next Friday with the two speakers from NASA on the Hubble Space Telescope and the James Webb Space Telescope. Thanks a lot for coming.